Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Welcome. Do you want to do it?
Welcome.
Welcome to Inside the Hive.
Welcome to Inside the Hive with your host, Nick Bilton.
And my guest.
And his guest is Kumail Nanjiani.
I'm so excited to have you here. I don't know if you remember, but I reached out to you like a year ago and I said, hey, you want to come on the podcast? And you were like, I'm too fucking busy for you.
I did not mean it like
that. You didn't actually say
that.
Well,
this is what happened. Yeah. I did so much press for almost a full year.
On the Big Sick?
Yeah, that then I decided to take 6 months completely off from being like doing literally anything. So I didn't promote Silicon Valley that season. I just was like, I don't want to be in front of people for a solid 6 months.
Well, thanks for, you're going to be here for a solid 6 months. This is a 6 month long podcast.
I'm very into it.
I want to start with a little story for our listeners about how you and I met. And what's that restaurant called?
I want to say it's called Farm Table.
That's
but
right.
It's,
that's
is
right.
Is that what it is?
I had gone to a meeting. I decided to stop at this restaurant for lunch. I was sitting at the bar next to you. We start chatting. I think we followed each other on Twitter.
And it was me and Martin Starr, right?
That's right. Yeah. And we had a great time. And then I said, see you guys later. This is, I think, first season of Silicon Valley.
Maybe yeah, might have been second season. Second season. Somewhere around there.
And I went home and a friend of mine, I said to him, oh, I mentioned that I met you today. And he goes, oh, I saw him carrying a giant dick into his house. Can you tell us the story of what that was?
Okay,
what
the
giant penis was?
It's I want to qualify, it was not a giant dick.
Well, what was it?
And it was not me carrying. So, okay, so I believe season two or season three of Silicon Valley, so that'll tell us exactly when we did meet. There's a bit where we hire like a graffiti artist to do a mural for us, mm-hmm. and he makes a huge thing of me having, can I say?
You can say, I just said the word penis.
Oh, yes.
And I said the F-bomb, so...
Okay, fucking the Statue of Liberty.
Oh,
it's
wow.
Like a
so that's
big
what it
visual
was.
Bit.
Okay.
And it's huge, right? It's the size of a garage door.
Yeah.
And there were two of them, because there's the bit slightly changes. And so, at the end of the season, they were going to throw it away.
So it's a giant garage door of you having sex with a giant Statue of Liberty.
Yes. Okay. I had assumed that the painting was a normal size painting that then they digitally made big for
uh-huh.
the show.
Uh-huh.
So they were going to throw it away, and I was like, Mike, can I have that? Me fucking the Statue of Liberty? And Mike was like, sure. I was like, they're like, we'll bring it to you. We'll deliver it to you. So my doorbell rings. Emily, my wife, is out of the house. I go out, and it's a massive flatbed truck. And the painting is life-size, so it's huge. It's bigger than, I mean, it would go on your garage. It's huge, and there's like tarp over, but they take the tarp off, and it's two guys, and I had just moved into my house that week. And it's a massive painting of me, very graphic, fucking the Statue of Liberty, and it takes these guys 40 minutes to carry this painting into my house.
And everyone across the street is watching.
And it's funny to me because either they know the show or they think this new neighbor just commissioned a painting of himself fucking the Statue of Liberty, which is so awful. And so they bring it in, and I am like, I am stunned. I don't know what to do. It took them 40 to 45 minutes. I am not kidding. Kids are walking by. Oh, my God. I'm like turning red thinking about it.
But then it gets worse, right?
Well, they bring it in, and it doesn't fit into my garage because it's too big. So they lean it up against the side of the wall, but the wall isn't that high. So you could see...
But didn't your in-laws come that following weekend?
They were going to... Well, they were about to show up, yes. So I called Emily, and they just... Those guys drove off, as was their job. They were like, where do you want me to leave it? And I was like, propped against this wall. And it barely covers it. Like, it's like waist high. So you don't actually see my penis, but you could see that I am fucking the Statue of Liberty, who is bent over. And so I call Emily. I'm like, hey, Emily, when you come home, there's going to be a surprise for you. So she got home and she's like, so what are we doing about this? And I was like, leaving it here? And she's like, we can't. And I'm like, you're right. She's like, my parents are about to show up. And so I called Silicon Valley again and I was like, guys, I am so sorry. Can you guys come and take this from me? So they show up 2 hours later, same day. And now it takes them an hour and a half to like carry this painting out and secure it to the flatbed truck and cover it with a tarp. And
that was it.
And then from what I understand, it went back into storage. And the last thing I heard,
it's in the Trump Hotel. Right?
No, well, close. There was a VC who wanted to get it and lined the bottom of a swimming pool with it.
Are you serious?
Yeah, but I don't know what happened with it, and I don't know the name of the VC.
Oh, my God. That's amazing. I did not know that part.
Yeah.
All right. Well, speaking of,
my God.
Good transition there. So there's a lot I want to talk to you about today, and I know there's things you want to talk about, but I have a question. Can I ask you? So you have a movie coming out, which is hilarious, and I want to get to it. It's called Stuber.
Yes.
Did I get that right?
Correct.
Laugh out loud, funny, amazing. But are we allowed to talk about like Trump and things like that? Like, what's the story here?
Well, you could ask me anything. I found in the last year or couple of years, I found me talking directly about Trump isn't really beneficial, because what happens is, I mean, you know that the discourse online is not even a discourse, it's just people yelling at each other. I found that if I'm saying stuff openly, anti-Trump stuff, I am half the people who already agree with me are agreeing with me, and the other people who either are supporters of him or like are kind of sick of hearing about this just turn you off, right?
So you were really vocal on Twitter, especially during like the immigration stuff a couple of years ago with the child separation at the border. And I don't really use Twitter anymore.
Yeah, I've sort of just used it for promotion.
I dropped in last night to kind of see what you'd been chatting about, and it's mostly you're not really... Are you done? Do you not use it as much?
Yeah, I'm done.
And what happened?
It was too toxic. It's too... It's a scary, awful, dark place, and the all that stuff about, you know, Jack not banning Nazis and stuff. I was so involved with that stuff, and it just was really disheartening when that stuff... when they basically didn't do anything. And so it's really become a cesspool. And I've sort of moved over to Instagram. I try and do that more.
Are you just like taking selfies of your six pack now? Or
like... We're not there yet. but I found Twitter, and it's really sucked.
He doesn't have a six pack, by the way.
I don't
I'm
have
sorry.
A six pack. Yet.
Yet.
Ask me in a month. I am actually working on it. It's sort of the thing that first made my career. Before anything, I was like tweeting a lot, and I was very popular on Twitter, and it allowed me to start touring and stuff, along with doing podcasts. But it's really, really turned. I mean, it's just become the language on there has become very antagonistic.
Well, so one of the things I like about you, you're very funny, you're kind of handsome.
Thank you so
like that.
Much.
That's not the things
that's
I like.
That's exactly what I... Oh, you don't like those things. No,
but is that you actually seem like you care. You genuinely do. Like the things you talk about, the things you get involved with, the projects and so on. You seem like someone who gives a shit. There's a lot of people whose careers take off in the way yours have who go in the complete opposite direction and only care about themselves. And so the question I have is, and this is the question I struggle with, and I'm sure a lot of people listening struggle with, is when you turn those things off. Like, so let's just take this week, for example. There was this gut-wrenching photo of this 23-month-old little baby who died with her father in her father's arms crossing the Rio Grande because the border wouldn't let her through.
Right.
It's really hard to look at. It had me in tears earlier, my wife also. The reason that everyone knows about it is because people on social media are talking about it.
Correct.
The reason that back, you know, when the child separation stuff was going on at the border was people were incredibly vociferous.
That's right.
So the I guess the question I have, and maybe you don't have an answer, but I'm just curious, is how do you balance it? Do we have a responsibility to be engaged in these conversations? And if so, where and how? And
I mean, that's something I think about a lot. I think that's a good point. You know, earlier I said that, and I used to have this conversation, I used to have this argument with Emily where she would say, you have to get off Twitter. The people who agree with you are the people who already agree with you. You're not really doing anything. But I was like, what you're doing, I think, is mobilizing people who agree with you, or at least that's the illusion. Or you're keeping things in the discussion, right? You're keeping it open. So that's still there. I found, I don't know if this is, so I thought about this a lot because the last few years have really been weighing on me and on everyone. I have, for the first time, I've not felt like myself. I've never had any sort of depression or anything. I don't have it in my family. For the first time a couple years ago, not to, you know, really discount people who go through it actually, but for the first time in my life, I sort of felt like, oh, I sort of now have a little bit of a window into what having something like this would feel like, right? The hopelessness and all that. So I sort of thought, I was like, how can I make a difference while in a way that feels like true to me? And I thought, okay, so there are, either you can fight against something or you can fight for something, you know. And there are people who are way better at fighting against stuff, and I think that's a very valid fight. I feel like I sort of am better when I'm going the other way rather than fighting something directly, sort of promoting a positive version of things.
So is that like the movies you're doing? Or
trying to, because I think the issue is, like, this is the epiphany. Not epiphany, but... So we made a movie called The Big Sick a couple years ago. And I found a lot of people who would talk about that movie were Trump people. They liked that movie. A lot of really, really right-wing people liked that movie. So when I would say something political, they would get upset. They're like, I was a big fan of yours after The Big Sick, but now I'm not so sure. That kind of stuff. So I was like, there has to be a way for art to affect and change people's way of thinking. Now, it's hard because you make a movie that you're spending 2 hours with them. Everything else that they're watching, Fox News or whatever it is literally the rest of their lives. So I think the only way that I can do something is try and Trojan horse things into the work I do. Because I do think speaking directly... I mean, that picture you were talking about, right? There are some people who are devastated by that picture, and there are some people who are not devastated by that picture. And I think there's no hope for the people who are not devastated by that picture. Some people are going to look at it and justify it with, like, well, they shouldn't have come here, or whatever it is. And I do think those people are hopeless. There's nothing to be done. But then sort of the other people, like my friend's parents, who are like, oh, I'm just sick of hearing about it. I don't like him, but, you know, this is too much. Everyone's talking about him too much. And so I'm hoping that instead of speaking directly against stuff, me doing stuff that portrays the ideals that are important to me has some sort of impact. Otherwise, it's, you know, I have to believe that. Otherwise, it's like, what the fuck am I doing with my life?
When, as we kind of rev up, and we won't stay on politics too long, I promise, but as we rev up to now, we're kind of entering this era of, you know, there's the debates this week, there's the...
I'm going to start getting more engaged as we get closer to the election. So I sort of pulled back then around the midterms.
Is this where you're going to announce your candidacy for president?
I think maybe I'll run as a Republican. How's that?
That would actually be pretty amazing.
So I sort of disengaged, and for the midterms, I sort of checked back in and did what I could do. And so at some point, I mean, I think right now the Democratic field is bananas. So wait a little bit. But as we get closer to the next election, I'm going to start chipping back in.
Who are you rooting for in the debates?
You know, it's hard. I mean, I really like Warren. I like Kamala.
Buttigieg?
I mean, it's so hard because I see people I know Biden has a lot of problems. Obviously.
Can't stand him.
Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah, my no, listeners. I think it's like 50 plus years in.
But you're still voting for him if it's him against Trump, right?
You know, it's interesting. I thought about that, and I would, but I would be, I would not be very happy about it. Honestly, I just
it counts the same. However you put that all in,
fuck.
I completely agree about the Biden thing. You know, obviously. A lot of issues. I like, but I name the candidates that I like. With Buttigieg, you know, I feel like he's had some stumbles recently.
We'll see. I think a lot of it's going to kind of play out on the stage in the next, you know.
I mean, I couldn't even name all of them.
There's too many to name. You would literally be here for the rest of the podcast.
Somebody joined yesterday.
Yeah. It was me. I'm running as an independent.
I should have remembered. You know who dropped out? The Starbucks guy dropped out? Howard Schultz?
Did he?
Oh, not officially. He didn't officially drop out, but he's like
disappeared. Yeah.
He said he had like back problems or something. My God.
It's like Trump with his shin splints getting out of Vietnam.
You know what's really scary? It seems like there's going to be another term.
I agree. It's terrifying. I think that we should probably have a brief moment of silence and a prayer for Ruth Bader Ginsburg to make sure she's going to be around.
Someone get her some orange juice. Yeah. Put a helmet on her.
She shouldn't be going out. She was at the theater a couple of weeks back.
Don't go to the theater.
Don't go. You could fall or something. Just popcorn or something.
Yeah, exactly. Just be laying in bed, drinking vitamin C, taking all your supplements. You know, she should get a blood boy, like those VCs.
Oh, yeah. So she should be pumping blood into...
Yeah.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
The 2024 election means this year is going to be chock full of drama and nail-biting suspense. You deserve a politics and news podcast with expert analysis. No spin, no BS. Just trusted journalists talking about what you need to know. I'm David Plotz, and each week on Slate's Political Gabfest, I sit down with the New York Times' Emily Bazelon and CBS News' John Dickerson to do just that. Join us as we unpack the latest in politics, news, and the courts. Listen to the Political Gabfest every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
So you have been on the show, Silicon Valley. Of course, you know that. You were on the show for six seasons now. Is that right? Is that
sixth one. We start shooting tomorrow.
Great. Fantastic. So
sixth and final season.
Is that exciting? Is that sad? Is it?
It's both. First of all, very sad. I'll never have a job like that, working with people I genuinely, genuinely love on a show that I'm a big fan of, that I think has something valuable to say, a show that I would watch even if I wasn't on it. So I will certainly miss it, but also we're going out on our own terms.
So, just like Seinfeld. So the question I have is, I remember when the show started, and I was like a very pro-tech person. Love tech.
Really?
It was great.
That's,
you know,
so interesting.
And now I'm like, I hate it. Like, it's terrifying.
Yeah.
We're building robots that are going to kill our children. Like, we're allowing China into it. Just the list goes on and on.
That's
and on.
That's right.
Social media, Twitter. I remember I was at the New York Times, and I wrote a piece, but I wrote two big pieces, one debating George Packer of The New Yorker, who's an amazing writer, and another debating Bill Keller, who was my boss, the editor-in-chief of The Times, both of them arguing about why Twitter was the greatest thing that had ever been invented.
And when was this?
This is right around the time my book came out on Twitter, about 2013 or so.
Okay.
And now I
You just, won.
I won.
Good for us.
Yay. I feel the complete opposite. I think that it's there's study after study after study showing how it affects kids and depression. There's, you know, we've seen what happened with the election with Russia. We see the way Donald Trump uses it. It is a cesspool. There and we see the way the people who now run the company and all of these companies, Twitter, Facebook, all of them they just don't care. And so the question I have for you is, how has your viewpoint changed, A,
yeah.
And B, how does this relate to the character you play on the show in the respect of how you feel about representing this place that has fucked everyone over?
Yes. So there was like a couple steps of evolution. When I first was auditioning for the show, I would tell people, hey, I'm auditioning for this Mike Judge show called Silicon Valley. And they were like, is it set in the 90s? And I was like, no, there's crazy shit happening right now. This was 2011, 2012. And so at that time, I'm sure you were very aware of Silicon Valley, but nobody knew Elon Musk. There weren't these like personalities that everyone knew about. People, you know, just weren't aware of it. And then very quickly, it became the people started sort of worshiping these people. From the beginning, I remember, this is going to sound like me saying, you know, I knew it and I didn't know it, but when we first went to Silicon Valley to show the first two episodes, we met all these VCs and CEOs. And I remember all of us being like, oh, these are like amoral.
Really?
Yeah, not like unethical, but sort of like aethical people. Like they just don't care about this stuff. Like their whole philosophy is tech is tech. It's not good or bad. It's how you use it. And that's not our job to mandate, you know? So right from the beginning, it was like that. And then we would have these, they would sort of take us on these tours. So like big companies, I don't want to name, but if you named, you know, all the big companies, they would like have us over and they wanted to give tours of us. And I did a big like thread about this a couple of years ago. They would show us around and show the new technologies they were working on. And they were terrifying. The ethical implications of these technologies were terrifying and obvious. And we would ask them, we would be like, isn't it bad that this... And they did not even have a fake answer ready to go. They were stunned that we were asking the question.
Because to them, it all looks amazing, right?
Yeah, they're like, oh my... This person listens to you the entire time and then recommends things to you. And you can never turn it off. It's always listening to you. Isn't that great? And you're like, what are you talking about? Don't you understand the misuse of what if somebody hacks into it? Or, you know, in this video, I take a picture of you. I take 20 minutes of you talking. And look, here's a video of you talking and sounding like you and saying crazy shit. Isn't that amazing? No, it's absolutely horrible. How can you not understand the ethical implications of that, right? But again, like I said, they were like, tech isn't bad. Tech is its own, it's amoral. And still, when I tweet about technology, there would be many, many people talking about how it's not their fault, technology is technology. The big problem is laws are not going to evolve fast enough to keep up with technology, and I think one of the big, obviously, climate change is a big thing. The other big threat to civilization right now is lack of ethics in technology. I know that there are technology ethicists, and I've spoken to some of them, but they just don't have any power. There are people who are thinking about this stuff, but nobody's really listening to them.
Does this, when you're on the show and you know that you're giving people a window into this world, is there a part of you that wants that to be part of the story?
Yes, certainly. More and more and more. And I've talked to them about it. And having read the first, I don't want to give it away, having read the first three scripts of the season, you know, we've had now 2 years off from the show. When I would talk to Alec and Mike, I would be like, you know, when we were first doing the show, people didn't know exactly what was going on. So we were doing that, we were satirizing it. People didn't know how tech had ruined the world. Now people know how these tech companies have ruined the world. And I think we have to really confront that and talk about it. And so that is a big part of this next season.
So you studied philosophy originally and ironically computer science. When you look at... So one of the things that I always struggle with and I talk to a lot of people about is we always talk about like what separates humans from animals, and there was a period of time for a long time where it was art. I don't actually think that's true. There's actually birds that make pretty art, and there's an elephant that can paint.
of course, the elephant
exception. But that's not the point. I think what separates humans from animals is our ability to build tools and technology that help us, in numerous different ways.
And that can be technology or can also be a system of laws or government. I think
correct.
It can be systems.
Yeah. So the thing that I have struggled with is that I am terrified of what these technologies are going to do in the future. You know, it's one thing for for our social media accounts to be, you know, taken over by algorithms and
algorithms are ruining us. You read that article?
Totally.
Was it in the Times about how YouTube algorithms made someone into an alt-right person, and then YouTube algorithms took them out of it? So there's no hope for this person. This is not a redemptive story arc. At the end, it was, again, an algorithm. They weren't like, oh my God, what am I doing? They're still led by robots.
Well, but the question is at the same time as these algorithms are being created to take people and make them into alt-right and this, that, and the other, and Russia to say who wins in the United States, they're also creating, you know, go back to the big sick, like they're creating technologies that are saving lives and identifying cancer before we know we have it and this, that, and the other. Do you have a solution that do you think of that would enable us to make decisions as we move forward that aren't going to kill us? That's the first question. The second question is, do you actually think that technology will destroy humanity?
I do think technology will destroy humanity, even if it's climate change. That's still, I would argue, that's still man-made technology that's doing it. This is going to sound, no, I don't think so. I remember, so when I was back in philosophy class, you know, in the late 90s, I remember we were debating like the ethics of like, there was like a, like China was trying to do human cloning, right? And we were arguing whether that's right or wrong. And I remember specifically having the thought. I was like, it doesn't matter if it's right or wrong. It's going to happen. Mm. It is going to happen. And that's how I feel about technology now. I mean, I don't think practically there is a way to not have technology ruin our lives. I mean, Facebook is so powerful.
Oh, it's terrifying.
Facebook is so powerful. Twitter is so powerful. Amazon is so powerful. I mean, I don't think...
Do you use all these things still?
I don't use Facebook. Mm. I still have an account on there, and I tried to delete it, and they were like, send us 2 notarized letters.
Is that why you...
No, I'm not joking.
Are you serious?
Yeah. It's crazy. I haven't used it in 2 years. Twitter I use for promotion. Instagram I use for promotion. And, you know,
I do use
Amazon.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
So here's the big question that I have, right? So I had this realization the other day. I'm working on some projects that to do with, you know, tech and the future and all the bad things that have happened. And I had this really, I was laying in bed and I got this alert and it was like, you've used your phone for 15 hours today. It wasn't that bad, but it's still pretty bad. And I was thinking to myself, like, is this thing, I stood to my wife, we were talking about Steve Jobs and she was like, you know, a lot of people think he's like the great creator who made this thing that changed the world. But at the end of the day, like the negatives of this device in my hand are in her opinion, in my opinion, actually do somewhat outweigh the positives. And it's great that you can take 1,000 fucking photos of your cappuccino. It's amazing. It's amazing that you and I can message each other. But like at the end of the day, if you took this device away, beyond the on-demand things that you can get from like Amazon Prime, I actually don't think it makes our lives that much better.
I completely agree with you. When I am forced to be off my phone, I feel better. And I try to institute a law like no phone for the first 10 minutes of the day. I got it from Zach Woods, who's on the show.
No, so what do? You wake up and you just look at it?
No, you don't do anything.
You just don't even talk to it.
Well, but I don't. And days where I stick to that, I feel better.
So what's your routine? You wake up. Go get a coffee.
I'll wake up, go make coffee, make breakfast, sit, eat and read. I will like read stuff
online.
Yeah, but I won't. I'll try not to look at Twitter or Instagram or my emails or anything. Because here's the thing about Twitter that I noticed is, so I have like almost 3 million followers, right? It's not just the toxicity that's bad. Even if I say something and it's all positive responses. I don't think human brains are meant to process that many people's opinions that quickly.
Oh, completely.
And so it's such an artificial setup. And I think that weighs on you, not just the negative stuff, but also the positive stuff. We're not made to use Twitter.
Without question. Yeah. I remember when Instagram first came out, and I wrote, I think, the second article ever on it, and I was obsessed with it. And I was like, this is the greatest thing ever. Like, it's going to change the way we take photos. And I've always taken photos. I've always had cameras as a kid and whatnot. And then I became obsessed with how many likes something would get. And I remember literally going... I was in San Francisco working at the Times, and I climbed this. I left work early. I went to Pacifica, and I climbed this hilltop, and I was there alone, like trying to capture the sunset. And I was like, "What am I doing?"
Yeah.
And I don't use Instagram anymore either. Like, I've been on there. Maybe I think I've posted two things in the last 2 years. Maybe.
Wow.
I will say the one benefit of Instagram is that if you unfollow people and you follow things you like I like old cars, uh-huh. It can become like a magazine.
Yes.
But I think posting to it is just as bad as posting to Twitter. And you live and you die by the good and the bad.
Well, I don't think it's just as bad as Twitter because I mean, I post on it. I don't really read the comments on Instagram. I don't really feel like I want to because it's not so much a conversation. Whereas on Twitter,
yeah,
the illusion is that it's a conversation, right? I think about this a lot. When I was back in a computer science major, I had a professor named John Stone. He's still there. He was a philosopher who was a computer science guy. And so he was older, and he had sort of been involved. I forget what the name of this... These computer scientists, sort of, when the internet was coming out and technology was, they made a system of ethics for it. It was almost like a manifesto of,
the early computer science folks?
Yeah, who had like a list of like, these are the rules and this is the thing. And it was extremely optimistic. And I remember one quote that he had on his desk that was something like, the rise of the internet is the promise of the return of voice, that everybody, of true democracy, of everybody's opinion being able to be heard, which on paper sounds great. And the original promise of the internet was you get to talk to people who you would never get to communicate with. You know, you get to discuss different points of view. You have access to people that you just would not have had access to. That was the good version of it. What we're seeing now is the bad version, is that you just talk to people who completely agree with you and then another set of people who completely agree with them, and they just spin each other out and then they occasionally yell at each other.
Twitter right there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I used to do a podcast about the X-Files called the X-Files Files, right? Long ago I did it. And I had this idea. I was like, the X-Files was the first TV show that had like a significant online fan base. Started in 93. So Google Groups has archived these old message boards going back at least, you know, 93. And so I would go and sift through and I would find old conversations from 93, online conversations about the X-Files. And back then, mostly universities had it, so mostly it was professors who had access to it. So the conversation was very civil. Everybody knew everybody's names. You could still see, you know, professor, whatever, you could see their real names. And it was a real discourse. It was a real conversation. People were talking about the show. And I remember the first time I saw, what is it called, those abbreviations like AFK or BRB and stuff?
Oh, yeah, like ASL, H sex location, I
remember when those started showing up. I remember when the first like emoji started showing up, like with the colon and the smiley face. And I saw from 93 to 98 how it became more and more antagonistic. I saw it happen. I saw people like getting upset at each other and calling each other names.
on these old message boards.
So
do you know the story of the well? So the back in the day, all these early internet pioneers created this essentially the first social network. It was called the well. And what they did was
When was this?
The well. This was 30 years. I mean, this is like a long time ago. This is pre X-Files, files, message boards, like beginning of the internet. You know, green computer screens and whatnot.
Hello world shit.
Hello world shit. And so so they create this thing, and people, you have to use your real name. This is just like the way they take it from the real world. And everyone start, they're having conversations about like scientific stuff and computer stuff and philosophy. And oh, it's like this, like the greatest place on earth for people to talk. And then someone suggests at some point, they're like, I want to talk about like really kind of personal stuff like depression or suicide or like sexual orientation or whatever it is. We should create a part of the well where you can have an anonymous name, like you can call yourself Snuffleupagus 123. And so they do it, and it's all these scientists. They didn't invite new people on, right? It's all these scientists and philosophers and researchers that are on there and are now allowed to create accounts. And instantly, it's like people telling them to go fuck themselves, like attacking each other, like anonymously. And eventually, of course, it shuts down. But that's my philosophy of what happened with places like Twitter.
I mean, that is so fascinating. Same people, which makes me think, you know, you were asking about what separates us from animals. And one of the things to me has to be society. I know animals have their own societies, but like a complicated society like this that requires a set of laws. And I realize like those laws... society works based on personal responsibility and accountability. And once accountability is gone, everything falls apart so quickly. You know, I never thought, people talk about like the inherent goodness of man. I never believed that. I don't think that.
You don't believe that men?
I don't think we have inherently a set of morals, that we were born with a sense of right and wrong. I think it comes from being in a society and what...
That's fascinating.
What's right and wrong is based on what makes a successful society.
Do you believe, what religion were you raised?
Islam.
Do you believe in God or some higher power or purpose?
I mean, I don't want to answer that question directly, but I think I sort of said it based on how I feel about the idea that there's no inherent right or wrong.
So you think that if we took... See, I totally disagree with you.
You think we're born with a sense of morality?
I think that we are born with a sense of morality that, and I look, I know like you can go look, you know, look at China, for example. China is a society where individualism it's not like America, right, where it's about the state, it's about, you know, and there is in some instances less morality than there is over here. But I still think that, and you can look at the Stanford Prison Experiment where the prisoners, of course, you know, the prison guards became awful. I think at the end of the day, the arc of history points towards goodness. And I think that that collectively that there is some underlying current that the side of us that is good and just and moral pushes towards. And I believe that is the case because if we experience things and we don't like them, we are built with a thing called empathy, and that we don't want that to happen to our kids and our family and our loved ones and so on.
Yeah, I think empathy is much more limited than we think. I mean, people can look at that picture of that little girl and her father drowning and not feel empathy. I don't think they're even fighting it. I think people can be very tribal, and if it doesn't look like you, then fuck them. And I, in my experience, have not seen any evidence of the fact that we are born with any innate sense of morality. And to me, proof of that a little bit is, not to use an extreme example, but Nazis, right? I mean, good people, normal people did
I'm
horrific.
I'm so glad we got to the Nazis.
See, there we go. But they did horrific shit, right? I mean, you saw this lawyer arguing for how safe and secure.
Oh, it was awful.
I'm sure that person does not think of themselves as a bad person.
She actually...
I saw.
She went online and...
To me, that read like such... Again, not to... I don't know.
No.
Such... So when I did philosophy, I focused a lot on conditions in concentration camps. I read Origins of Totalitarianism by Hannah Arendt. I read Eichmann in Jerusalem, all that stuff. These people were just doing their job. They didn't think they were doing anything wrong. They truly didn't think they were doing anything wrong. So I think good societies make good people for the most part, and bad societies make bad people for the most part.
Well, this is really depressing.
What happened? I know. And I have never, ever, I consider myself a very, very optimistic person. And I, until the last couple of years, I've always believed that, not always, since I was like 18 or 19, since I started thinking about this stuff. I've always believed that, but it never used to depress me. In fact, it was inspiring.
You're listening to Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton.
So what role do you think comedy plays in society, especially we're born with certain things, right? The animals don't laugh at each other. They don't tell jokes. I mean, they may laugh at each other, like, you just don't realize it, but they don't tell each other jokes. Like,
no.
That's pretty, we can pretty much say, like, I don't know if my dogs are thinking about, like, why am I here, but I'm pretty sure they're not, like, telling each other jokes.
Right.
And yet, comedy is such an important part of society. I mean, it's like, I watched the movie that you have coming out, with my wife this weekend, and it was hilarious, and we laughed out loud, and there's these great lines that I think about over and over again that are just really funny and clever, and it kind of took me out of this, like, this moment that we're in with the immigration stuff and Trump and 2020 and this, that, and the other. And there's part of me that actually, funnily enough, feels a little guilty about that. But there's also this is a question I have for you, is like, but there's also part of me that thinks, like, without that, we would all be just, like, depressed.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So the question, I guess, is from a philosophical standpoint, what role do you think comedy plays? Is it a safety feature? Like, is it a feature? And at the same time, like, how do you wrestle with the fact that, going back to the conversation we started with about, like, what's important to spend your time on and the things, the battles you pick, about where to focus your time when it comes to, like, these comedic expenses?
Yeah, I mean, I have to believe that comedy has the power to change the world. I mean, I have to believe that. I don't know if that's a defense mechanism for the life I've chosen, to justify the life I've chosen. I have to believe that it does something, you know. There is that thing that comedy is sort of like Wizard of Oz, you know. You go to this other realm, and when you come back, you can live your boring life better or whatever. It can be like grease for the capitalist machine or whatever. But I do think, ultimately, comedy is a great vehicle for a point of view, for opinion. And so I have to feel that if you're making a joke that has a strong point of view, like if I make a joke about that sort of, I don't know how I would do this, but then the core truth of the joke is that immigrants are human beings. I have to believe that if you laugh at that, that that gets inside you and that idea affects you in some way, because comedy is such a primal response. It's not a learned response. Laughing is not a learned response. It's very involuntary. And so I have to think that that involuntary response has to make you internalize whatever the core truth of the funny joke is. So, and I think it goes, I mean, you know, there's comedy on all sides, representing all points of view. So I don't know what the role of comedy is in society. I don't know if it's like a safety mechanism. I do think that there's value in laughing at something and coming out of the malaise you're in and, you know, renewing the fight, renewing your vigor or whatever. But I also, I think that it has to be able to affect change. Otherwise, I mean, what else is there?
I actually do think it does. I mean, speaking back to the Nazis.
I mean, if you look at, like, for instance, like Will and Grace, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it made people less homophobic. It really did.
Yeah.
Modern Family. It really did. And now, obviously, we're in a weird new era. And I've seen I've seen comedy from the other side because I do want to be, I am interested in what's going on.
You mean comedy from the right?
Yes.
You mean on the internet?
Yeah, on YouTube and stuff. I mean, there are very popular right-wing comedians. I don't want to name them. I'll tell you after the podcast.
And wait, are they funny?
No.
Oh.
Those guys are not funny. But first of all, they're not funny because they're not funny. I like to think that as a comedian, even if I disagreed with a joke, I'd be able to understand the structure or whatever. They're not funny. But also, maybe to me, they're not funny because I disagree with the premise so much, you know?
Huh.
You gotta. If you want to get really upset, I'll send you some clips. Don't do it.
You know, I'll hang out with my children and be happier.
Yeah.
As a human being. All right. So, last few questions for you, and then we're gonna let you go to the gym and work on your six pack. have you, as someone who has been steeped in the Silicon Valley world for a long time, I'm sure you've come up with some pretty good apps.
Dude, it's the last thing I want to think about. Apps have ruined the fucking world. I want nothing to do with it. You asked me earlier. My opinion towards Silicon Valley from season one was fairly negative, and it has gotten more negative.
So here's a question. If you could kind of, I don't know if it's shut them down, or if you had the power to do something to like the Facebooks and the Googles and the Amazons, you don't have to name names, what would be the solution if you were the one that was deciding? If Congress called you up, which could actually happen.
I don't know how practically you would shut them down.
But would you break them up?
Yes. I would, in a perfect world, I would kill all social media. And I think that there would be an adjustment period. But like you said, I think ultimately it would be better for us. And I think people would realize that it would be better for us. I mean, it's changing the way kids are. People are different now.
Okay, but you would kill social media, and I'm just going to push back because I struggle with this. But if it wasn't for social media, would we have the Me Too movement? Would we have Black Lives Matter? Would we?
There are positive aspects to it. I mean, there was a civil rights movement without Twitter.
It's true.
But obviously, there's good and bad, but I think
That's the thing about the phone that bothers me the most, is that when you look at everything that it does, it hasn't created anything new great. It's taken things that already exist and in some instances made it better, but most of the time made it worse.
Yeah.
For the people involved. Like, there was a civil rights movement, as you said, before there was Twitter. I took photos on a camera that wasn't digital before my iPhone. And those photos meant more than these things. I will say the one good technology with the iPhone is when they make those little videos of like, here's you and your family over the last year, and they play like the music, and you're like, those make me cry.
Yeah,
they're really sweet. But
yeah, no, they've really figured it out. They know us.
But at the end of the day, the more I interact with it, the more
I find myself more than ever getting into a spinning thing and not being able to get out. Like, you know. And I think it has to do with phones. And even when I'm not on a phone, it's changed the way I think. It's changed my thought pattern so that it's, I find it a little bit harder to focus on tasks. Because you're so used to moving around and stuff. I think that's real. I don't think I have a big issue with it, but it's something that I've noticed that I am aware of. I mean, listen, I'm not saying there aren't positive aspects to it. Obviously there are, but I think ultimately, I mean, the negative aspects are just so. You can name two or three good things and a million bad things. Even the way that people talk about movies has changed. You know, even like small stuff. Like, I think film criticism has changed.
Oh, completely.
People, the way I see, you know, I'm a huge fan of movies, so I follow a lot of movie critics on there. Critics I like. And sometimes the way they talk to each other is so disheartening, where I'm like, you're both smart people. Can't you have a better conversation about disagreeing on the quality of a movie than this?
Well, what I find really fascinating is if you want to go dig through the old archives, go look at like the Times and the Post and some of the criticism of movies like back in the day of like Ghost and things like that. And even when they didn't like it, it wasn't vicious. Now, I have friends who have movies come out, and like you look at the reviews, and you're like, "Holy shit!"
It's an arms race to see who can like destroy a movie in the most thorough manner. So let me ask you this. Yeah. We talked about this very briefly. You wrote an article about it, right? How you thought that social media was on its way out. At some point, we're going to look back and be like, I cannot believe we did social media for that 10 years of human existence or whatever. Do you still feel like it's going to go away?
So I goes back to that story of the well, and I think that they shut it down. And I think that
they did, yeah, because of what you said.
Yeah, and I think, look, here's the thing I will say about people like me and tech, and when I say people like me, I'm people who were enamored with it at one point, who've covered this world, who've lived it, who've even built things in it, is that more and more you see, I've always felt that the people who were at the forefront, the ones signing up for it, identifying it, were kind of at the forefront of what was going to be the norm. And I remember when Twitter first came out, signing up for it, when it was at South By that first year in 2006, getting on the phone with Jack Dorsey and Biz Stone and all those guys, and like hearing about what they thought it was going to be. And I remember saying to this guy, Mike Young, who I worked with at the New York Times in the research labs, I was like, we were like, this is going to be something. Like, this is going to be really big. And I believed, and I'm an idiot for this, I truly do believe this, like, I only looked at it with rose-colored glasses. I didn't think, like, oh, what's the negative? Because I'd never really experienced firsthand the negative of technology, you know? I didn't grow up during the Cold War, or I did, but I didn't, I was a little kid. Like, and so I only looked at the positive, and now, more and more and more, it's not even people I know who have quit. I don't know people that are on it. Like, I barely know anyone who uses Twitter personally anymore. I still go in like a couple times a day because I just need to be aware of what I'm talking about when I have people like you on the show. But I hate it. I feel gross after. Yeah. Like, I just like got an STD or something. And I don't know. I honestly don't know anyone personally who still uses Facebook. And when I look at all the people I know who worked at Facebook in the early days who have left the company and regret what they built, I think that we will look back one day and we will say to ourselves, like, that was a big fucking mistake.
But how will it shut down? I don't see Facebook shutting themselves down.
I don't think it shuts down.
You think people sort of pulling out enough and not doing it?
I think that there's two worlds. Like, one is... you know, you're seeing it morph in real time right now. Like, there are more and more people. Did you see this meme this last week, last couple of weeks? The country song. I forget the guy's name who sings it.
Lil Nas X, that guy?
No,
I don't know the country song.
I don't know who the guy is, but it's this country song, and it's like, where you, I forget the name, but it became, there's a little verse in it where you like do this little dance and it's like, you know, grab your partner, spin around. And I ended up like in this wormhole of watching it. And I said to my wife, and I was like, this is the good part of the internet. Like, it's the fun, cultural, it doesn't justify all the bad stuff in any way, shape or form. And I would throw that out in a heartbeat. But I think that, but the way that meme spread, it wasn't on Twitter, it wasn't on Instagram, it wasn't on YouTube, it was on TikTok. And the reason I say this is because I think that, like, there is this undercurrent shift taking place. I'm not saying that TikTok is a good place, but I'm saying it's a different place. And I think that the reason people bounce from one place to the next is for two things. One is they're trying to fight the algorithm that knows them better than they know themselves. And the other is they're not happy in the thing they're in. And my hope is that enough people move from thing to thing to thing to the point that these companies have no choice but to change or they get eaten by something else.
Yeah. I just had a couple thoughts. One, you know, memes is an interesting thing. Obviously, it's sort of shared meaning and it's created by a community and I see the positive aspect of it. But like all the responses with GIFs and stuff, I'm going to sound like such a fuddy-duddy, but I think it's people are getting worse and worse at expressing themselves. And I think I mean, I think language separates us from fucking animals, right? And people are getting worse and worse at it, and people speak in the same phrases. They, you know, they reference the same memes. Yep. They use the same gifs. It's, you know, Michael Jackson eating that popcorn, whatever. And the first time you see it, you're like, clever. You're like, I had another computer science professor, Sam Hrabowski at Grinnell, and he wanted us to write papers about algorithms and this kind of stuff. And his thing was, he was like, do not use any phrases. Don't use cliched phrases. Like I don't want people to say, suffice it to say, find your own way to say it, or that kind of stuff, right? So he really would dock a third of a grade if you'd use a phrase that was sort of an autopilot phrase.
Mm-hmm.
And that really made me aware of how many times I speak in ways that are, you know...
Like everyone else.
Like everyone else. Yeah. And I think these gifs are like an extreme version of that.
That I can see that. I totally agree with that. I completely see what you're saying. I just think... I think that there's a... There is a part of it that is positive, but it is not big enough.
And I see the positive too.
Yeah, I've said this before many times on the show, is that Kevin Kelly, who helped found Wired and is written a million books on technology and the future, he always says that, you know, if the technology makes something better 51% and worse 49%, then it's a good thing. It sucks for the 49%, but it's a good thing. And I think that social media has flipped in the other direction so far. I think it makes things better 5%, if that.
Right.
And for me, I think that I think that for me, like, to get a little annoyed for a second here, like, when I look at these people that I've covered for 10, 12, 15 years who run these companies,
uh-huh.
Jack Dorsey, Sheryl Sandberg, Mark Zuckerberg, everyone involved at the top level of Google, and even Bezos, like, I think that it's vile that they do so, and YouTube too, like, that they do so little to try to make it better. And at the end of the day, all they care about is the money and the power and the attention. And
the power is a big part of it. Yeah. I think Zuckerberg really likes that his platform is so powerful. He made something that changed civilization. He really did. The other thing I want to say is, you know, earlier we were talking about how I think morality is created by human beings in a society. And I know that can sound a little cynical and negative. I don't see it as cynical and negative. I really think our relationships with other people, community, what we create together, is literally the most important thing. My relationships with people are literally what make me a person. And the morality that comes from that, even if we make it, doesn't make it any less beautiful or magical or important.
Well, it's interesting because we had Scott Galloway on the podcast a couple weeks ago. He just has this new book out called The Algebra of Happiness, and he did all this research about, like, what makes people happy. And he looked, you know, spoke to all these scientists and looked at all these paper. And at the end of the day, he said the thing that makes us happy is our connections with other people.
Yeah.
That is it. It's not money. It's not things, it's not, you know, it's the connections with other people.
To me, that's the core of being a person, and I think everything that comes from that is truly beautiful and magical, and to me, just as valid as stone tablets that say how we should act to each other. You know, it's something that we came up with together.
All right, so last two questions. The first is, we're going to do something, we're going to do the good and the bad. We'll do the bad first, because why the hell not? So what is the thing that you're most worried about from a technological standpoint in the future, or from anything standpoint? And then the second is, I'm going to ask you, since you're a comedian and you're funny, if we can end on a good note, if you have like a funny story, if you can tell a joke, if you can do a little improv.
Oh my God. Well, okay, so the bad. The thing I think about a lot, there's so much bad, but I think what technology has done that is the most insidious, that to me is going to be the hardest to change in the way we see ourselves, is devaluing privacy. You know, I talked about reading Origins of Totalitarianism, and she talks about how people having personal private lives is very important to a just society. And technology has made it so that it's not even something that we value at all. People want to live their lives completely publicly. And it's funny that I'm the one saying this, as someone who is forced to live his life somewhat publicly. But I think that that's something that's really changed. You know, you'll have arguments with people that they're like, who cares if they're listening all the time? I don't do anything bad. I don't care. I mean, to me, that's what really scares me, even if social media goes away. Well, maybe people will reset. The other thing I've learned from Twitter, you said, you know, how Trump uses Twitter and how Trump talks on Twitter. His sentence structure is everywhere now. Everybody talks that way. Have you noticed? Even people that you agree with will use that sentence structure, which is like something and then sad exclamation mark or scary exclamation mark, whatever. Everyone talks like that. And I don't want to name people specifically, but the way that even the idea of truth has been eroded is used by both sides, I think.
Yeah, completely. I remember the first time when Trump used fake news to respond to the Russia stuff, and then...
That was a term coined to talk about news on the right that was fake.
Yeah.
And he took that term.
Yeah. And instantly after he took it, you saw all these Democrats doing the same thing, and you were like, what the fuck? You're literally making this a part of our vernacular, and it's going to erode it on all sides.
Yeah.
So... All right, give us something.
Can I just talk about the movie?
Yes.
I'll just talk about the movie.
The movie's fantastic.
Thank you, Stuber. So this goes back to what we were talking about. It's a very, it's like an action comedy from sort of like Lethal Weapon or Midnight Runner. Those like sort of a throwback action comedy, like a very dude, very male-seeming movie. I thought it would be interesting if we were able to have a conversation about masculinity in it. And so that's kind of what was exciting to me about the movie. Obviously, we're in an era where we're looking at masculinity and all the bad it's done. It does bad, you know, it obviously has been very harmful to women, but also to men. I think we're imprisoned by it. And so in this movie, we wanted to have that conversation. And I feel like pop culture, mainstream pop culture, you can make indie movies, and I love those movies, that have your point of view in it, but you're not going to reach people who aren't going to go see that thing, you know? So I really feel the future, and I think Marvel and all of them have this responsibility, and I think Marvel is actually doing a pretty good job of it, of using big mainstream entertainment to get ethical points of view out there. So I think that's like the great, like, you know, and I think it's working more and more. I mean, look at Get Out, right? That's mm-hmm. a movie with a very, very strong sociological point of view. And it was a massive hit.
Yep.
I think people want that stuff. So I think that's going to be, I hope, the next big... I know entertainment's changing so much, and you've talked about it on your show with streaming and all that. But I think the next big movement is going to be big pop culture stuff that engages with bigger ideas than it traditionally has. And that... makes me, even though it's not funny, it makes me feel optimistic about the industry I'm in.
Oh, I completely 1,000% agree. I think that the biggest responsibility and the biggest, I think that, you know, years ago, you know, like bringing it back to where we started, that picture of the little girl on the cover and her dad on the drowned is on the cover of the New York Times this week. And years ago, it would have literally changed the conversation in ways that you couldn't even imagine. I think it was 30, 40 years ago when there was the picture of in Africa of a little kid bent over, curled over, uh-huh. and there was a vulture behind it.
Yeah, my God.
It changed, literally changed the conversation. It changed aid. It changed everything. And that photo, one of the problems, I think, with technology and the news consumption that we do is that it's all kinds of blends together.
That's exactly
you go on the Daily Mail website, and by the end of it, you're like, oh,
exactly
another person killed
is.
17 people today, like whatever. And I think that I remember I had written a bunch of articles for the Times about AI and all the things that could go wrong with it, like 8 years ago. And it was literally like an Olympic diver in a swimming pool, just... no one even talked about it. And then Ex Machina came out. And it was like all people could talk about was like AI. And that was my first realization of like, oh, the conversation is switching where it may begin in the news industry, and the news industry still has a massive impact. But for a lot of things, it is actually going to be pop culture and film and books and things like that that are going to really kind of hit you with that tidal wave and affect change.
Yeah, that's how I feel, and so that gives me hope and also something to try and work towards, because you don't want to think that you're just making stuff to distract people.
No, there's the great line in the movie that I keep thinking about, where your character is pulling up to the like projects in this ghetto house, and you're like, wow, this neighborhood hasn't been gentrified at all.
Yeah.
It's like such a, even just that little line is like, it makes you think about like what's going on in
right.
the city. And
exactly. Yeah, it's great. Exactly. Yeah.
When does the film come out?
July 12th. It comes out a week after Spider-Man, a week before Lion King. It's tough in the summer, but I do hope people go see it, because
it's
I am
a great film. It's
very
really
proud of it. I'll tell you, I've done movies that I'm not proud of, and I would not be talking about them like this. So I would say, of the things I've done, you know, I've been very lucky in that I've been a part of things that have that I'm really proud of. Silicon Valley, Big Sick, Portlandia, and now this movie. I feel like those are the things that represent me in some way.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time today. This has been fantastic, as always.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. We have a friend in common, Lee Eisenberg.
We do.
And we're doing a show together.
Oh, that's right. You got another thing. This, actually, I'm very excited about.
Yes, it's called Little America. It's an Apple TV Plus
production.
Show. Yeah. And it's Alan Yang is also one of the EPs. My wife, Emily Gordon, and I are EPs, and we wrote an episode. It's basically an anthology show based on true stories of immigrants. And again, we didn't want to make a show that had an overtly political agenda. The only agenda of this show is that immigrants are human beings, and that's it. You know, these are just like fun, interesting stories to watch. Some are big, some are small, but I'm really, really proud of this show. And Lee's, I mean, done a wonderful, wonderful job with
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, I'm really excited. That'll come out in the fall sometime.
And then when does Silicon Valley come out?
I don't think we have a date yet. I don't know. Yeah. I would guess, if I had to guess, I would say end of the year.
All
pretty
right.
soon.
Cool. Well, I hope it touches on the stuff we're talking about.
I hope it's a very angry season of television.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Thanks to my guest this week, Kumail Nanjiani. If you enjoyed this conversation, and I'm sure you did, be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive with Nick Bilton. That's me. You can find these on applepodcastradio.com or anywhere you get your podcasts. Don't forget to leave a review while you're there, preferably a really nice one. No one cares if all you have to say is something negative. That pretty much sounds like my podcast. Anyway, thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for the production work, and of course to my sponsors this week, Lightstream, Fiverr, and BetterHelp. Please support them the same way you support this podcast. Go to their website, check out the offers they have. Thanks so much. I'll see you all next week.
In the 1980s and 90s, New York City needed a tough cop like Detective Louis Scarcella.
Putting bad guys away, there's no feeling like it in the world.
He was the guy who made sure the worst killers were brought to justice.
That's one version.
This guy is a piece of shit.
Derek Hamilton was put away for murder by Detective Scarcella.
In prison, Derek turned himself into the best jailhouse lawyer of his generation.
And the law was my girlfriend. This is my only way to freedom.
Derek and other convicted murderers
started a law firm behind bars.
We never knew we had the same cop in the case.
Scarcella.
We got to show that he's a corrupt cop.
They can go f*** themselves.
I'm Steve Fishman.
And I'm Dax Devlin Ross. And this is The Burden. Listen to new episodes of The Burden starting March 19th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to hear episodes 1 week early and ad-free with exclusive content, subscribe to True Crime Clubhouse on Apple Podcasts.
From PRX.